Normally, we are not very much disturbed these days when we hear that somebody has left the fold of Protestantism to join the Roman Catholic Church. But one this summer has disturbed me very much, and that is Edith Sitwell, the brilliant English writer, one of the keenest women alive. And I think what disturbed me most was the reason that she gave in the press for leaving the Anglican Church to become a Roman Catholic. She said she joined them because of the discipline, the fire, and the authority which she found. It is of the first of the three that I would speak tonight. Discipline. Edith Sitwell is absolutely right in seeking a religion that has discipline in it. She is wrong in supposing that she has to go to one particular branch of Christianity to find it, because this has been inherent from the beginning in the mainstream of Christendom. It is a topic that is coming back into our common thought, whereas a few years ago we despised it. And so I'd like to share with you tonight the very best thinking on this, of which I am capable. We know that without discipline, there is no possibility of a Christian life. A person who simply lives for the day, and as the winds of freedom blow, will live poorly. You could not maintain marriage on that basis. You could not maintain the state. You could not maintain business. You certainly could not produce anything like success in the arts or any other genuine achievement of the human spirit. The uncontrolled life is not worth living. I don't need to argue this point with this audience. I'm sure we all believe it, and we're glad that we know it. And in some form or other, everybody here has undoubtedly tried to follow some kind of a voluntary discipline of his own. I realize that very few people come to Massanetta unless they are already committed Christians. And I'm sure they don't walk up the hill in this storm unless they are. So this is the beloved society that we have in the auditorium tonight. Only the righteous have appeared. And so our concern is how those who are already committed may then begin to have a discipline that will make their Christian life more effective. Now at this point, we are all perplexed, because we are usually not satisfied with the forms of Christian discipline which we have seen or of which we have heard. Now, the most common ones in the recent past, and indeed for a good many hundred years, are five as follows. Discipline in regard to food, in regard to sleep, in regard to sex, in regard to amusement, and in regard to dress. I have no doubt that these have occurred to nearly all the people here when they hear the topic mentioned. Now let's see what we have done in each of these. Now that Edith Sitwell is a Roman Catholic, she will, of course, follow the practice of meatless Fridays, as do the great majority of Roman Catholics all over the world. Not completely, of course, but to a very large extent. They believe that curbing their appetite for meat at one point in the week
is a beneficent reminder. Then they and many other Christians also have periods, such as Lent, in which something might be given up for many days. The other great world religions have these also. Conspicuously, we know of this in the month of Ramadan for Islam. And so far as I know, there is no great world religion without some kind of fasting in regard to food at some point. And though we smile about it and have lots of laughter, it may for many people be helpful. And I should be the last to cast scorn upon it. Now we all know that there are ways of getting around it. A Catholic priest told me about one of their members who on Friday went into a restaurant and asked for whale steak. They said, "Why, we don't have any whale steak." "All right," he said, "give me a T-bone. God knows I asked for fish." Well, this may happen. And it's not very edifying when it does. And of course, we all realize that, especially if you like fish, there's no very great cross in having it at least once a week. Also, we know that the people of Islam, some of whom I'm closely connected with now in the Voice of America, have their ways of getting around their difficulties. You may have supposed that all Muslims are teetotalers. Well, you're wrong. They're not. The Quran says you mustn't drink wine. It doesn't say a word about whiskey, because Mohammed never heard of it. There are ways in which we get around these things. A pastor of the Presbyterian Church in Kentucky was offered by one of his members some cherry brandy on the condition that he announced the gift in the church bulletin. The pastor said, "Certainly, I'll be delighted to do that. I don't mind putting it in the bulletin." So they waited till Sunday, and on Sunday in the bulletin it said, "The pastor thanks go to Mr. Jones for his gift of fruit and the spirit in which it was tended." Now, obviously, if you want to get around any of these disciplines that way, you can. And there are no doubt people always who have done so. This is one of the reasons why this particular kind of discipline has come into a good deal of disrepute. I also mentioned the one on sleep. There are groups, especially in the monasteries, who break their sleep every night in the world. Often they arise at strange hours for meditation, so that they never have that lovely, long, unbroken sleep which we so prize. I tried it last night. I got up at 5 minutes of 5. The porter on the Norfolk and Western said he'd get me up at Shenandoah. And so he did get me up at Shenandoah. And that was 5 minutes to 5, and I got off the train at 5:15, and then came to Masaneta and had another hour and a half before breakfast, and it was just wonderful. I must say, I didn't feel quite as sorry for the monks after that. I found it was very nice having 2 nights' sleep instead of one. And yet, we all admit that it would be a hardship upon us to have our sleep curbed as much as some people have it. And the great Dr. Johnson, in his prayers and autobiography, mentioned that probably oversleep was the greatest of his sins. And he frequently, in his famous prayers, prayed that God would forgive him for self-indulgence in sleep. And if any of you feel that this sin is yours, it might be good for you to think of that. Third of the common ones is the discipline of sex, which, of course, is represented in most of the religions by having groups who are voluntarily and for religious reasons living life of continual celibacy. We can understand that there might be very good reasons why people should do this. I can easily see that sometimes on the foreign mission field, such as in China today, a single man or a single woman can do things that nobody can do with children. Can have a kind of an independence. And remember, you and I, when we came to have children, lost some of our independence. And there are dangerous things that we are not now free to do as we were once free. And so, I'm willing to admit, as I think you are, that there may be cases in which discipline at this point is sound. I have no doubt it was a good thing for Augustine, with all of the moral dangers in his life, to make the big change to celibacy that he made. And maybe that's one of the reasons why he produced such an effect upon mankind. Even Mahatma Gandhi had the same conception, even in marriage. But having said this, we must hurry on to say that we are very glad that in our great major stream of Christianity, biblical Christianity that we try to represent, we have not supposed that the marriage state was in any way a second-rate condition. I'm very glad that we have the married clergy. And when you realize, as was mentioned from this platform this afternoon, how much more able, on the whole, the children of ministers are, you begin to see what a terrible loss there would be to our civilization if we had maintained throughout Christendom the practice of the celibate clergy. I thank God that we don't have it. I'm very glad that the Wesley household existed. I'm very glad they didn't practice birth control, because then we would never have had Jesus, lover of my soul. Charles, I believe, was the 15th child of Susanna. And she had four others after that. And we're glad she did. It was a great contribution. For one thing, we wouldn't otherwise have the Methodist Church. And with all of its sins, I'm glad it exists. It produces a man like Dr. Chappell, for example. While I'm mentioning the Methodists, I really think I owe you a story about them. My summer home is near the famous inn at Buck Hill Falls in the Pocono Mountains. And you probably know that many religious conferences are there. They're a little higher toned than the Massanutten conferences, otherwise they're the same. It costs more per day. And every year, the big wheels of the Methodist Church meet at Buck Hill Falls. They hope to have a little quicker influence by doing that, a little spirituality. And at the last conference they had, nearly all of the bishops were there, and practically every bishop demanded a room by himself. I gather they didn't have their wives, and they didn't want roommates. So this put a terrible pressure on the inn for the room. Now, I was there at another conference just soon afterwards, and one of the little waitresses in the dining room said, "I know why Jesus was born in the stable. The bishops had all the rooms in the inn." If this wasn't a Presbyterian-owned place, I'd tell a Presbyterian story, but as it is, I don't think it would be suitable. I mentioned also the familiar disciplines in regard to amusement. And probably many here in their childhood heard a good deal of these. In many cases, our ancestors felt that it helped their growth in spirituality to avoid tobacco and the theater and card playing and dancing. And sometimes this was made practically the test of the Christian life. And it may be that you know folks even to this day for whom this is the major Christian discipline. Most of us have objected to this on highly Christian grounds, chiefly because we realize that what this does is to take little things and put them out of all proportion to their weight, that it makes self-righteousness unusually easy. And furthermore, we know that there are many people who have had these forms of pleasure, who are certainly better Christians than I am. And as long as I know that that is the case, I know that these, not one of them, can be the necessary standard for entrance into the Christian life. And I believe that there's been this great feeling all over our land. And one of the reasons why discipline fell into disrepute was because of this kind of emphasis. I mentioned four, you see. Food, sleep, sex, amusement. The fifth most common one in the recent past has been in regard to clothing. All of you know that I'm a Quaker. I suppose for over 100 years, all of my ancestors on both sides, maybe for 200 years, all wore plain garb. We may see some plain garb in this room tomorrow. Probably will, since it is the day in which we are honoring the Church of the Brethren, and both the Brethren communities and the Mennonite communities are rather strong in the Shenandoah Valley. And we'll probably see some ladies here, girls, with prayer caps. We still have just a very few Quakers who wear the plain garb. I know one man in New Jersey who wears a collarless coat and a broad-brimmed hat and no necktie, eschewing all of these things, of course, as well. And then I can name some places where you'll see a few ladies now in bonnet. But on the whole, it has gone away. And the chief reason that it has gone away is that we began to see that for many people, this was not simplicity, but its opposite. That this was drawing attention. I suppose that President Eisenhower's grandmother, certainly his mother, wore plain garb as a young woman, as a member of the River Brethren. And there probably are lots of people in this congregation whose ancestors were in some such situation. And I don't want to dishonor them at all. I realize the glory of it. And I know that frequently it was a good discipline. For example, Elizabeth Fry mentions in her journal how at the age of, I believe, 19, she put off her beautiful worldly clothes and donned the gray costume and the shawl and the bonnet which she wore as long as she lived. And she said that it was a reminder to her of her Christian calling, of her responsibility. That when she went in company, she did not feel so greatly many of the temptations which she would have felt if she had been inconspicuous. Now, we can see that that discipline would be helpful, and I suppose it is to this day, to some people. And yet, there is no chance whatever of our recovering it. It is gone, and probably well gone for most Christian people, because it made too much emphasis on a little thing, and often people became very self-righteous in priding themselves on the plainness of their costume, which often cost more because they had to be ready-made. Now, if those are pretty well gone, those five, what is the way out? And what was wrong with them? Did you notice that each of those was negative? In each case, it was curbing something that you might want. Food, sleep, enjoyment. Each has been essentially negative. And there has been something about this negativity that has made it very easy for the situation to develop so that we became legalistic. This is what the Pharisees did. They wanted to keep the Sabbath, and the Sabbath is a good thing to keep. But they worked out a legalistic scheme of what you couldn't do. You couldn't go farther than this on the Sabbath day. You couldn't prepare more than this much food. A discipline, yes, a reminder. But it led so easily into an arid legalism that destroyed the very purpose that they originally had. Furthermore, the tendency in all of these cases is that where you have something conspicuous, like the dress or the celibacy, to make that the test of Christianity. And whenever you do that, you're on dangerous ground. What we want in a discipline is not a test of Christianity by which we can rule others out as not being in the kingdom because they don't subscribe to these practices. What we want is something that will be a helpful reminder to poor, sinful, feeble, faltering, perplexed, confused people that we are. What we want is not a standard of righteousness, but a device to help the unrighteous. See how different that is? And my guess is that if we'd always keep that in mind, then the danger of legalism, which always seems to lurk with any emphasis upon discipline, would thereby be entirely obvious. Well, since nearly all of those, or all of them, are negative in essence, is it possible that we might develop a group of disciplines for our day suitable for Christians like ourselves, which would be positive? I think we can. And again here, there seem to be five. I'm glad to see that a good many of you are taking notes. I hope you will, those of you who wish to think this through, because this is where we're thinking together. You can well know that I don't claim to have the last word on this, though I've thought about it a long time, and as you know, I've written about it. I'm still struggling, but I'm telling you tonight at Massanetta where I've got. And you may be sure that this is the first time that I've spoken for the full time on this single subject. The first of the positive disciplines is the discipline of time. What a precious thing it is. And how brief the time is. As I was riding on the Lackawanna yesterday from Buckhill Falls to New York, I got to thinking of a lot of people that I wished I had time to see. A fellow who graduated in high school with me a long time ago, and now he's in the Metropolitan Museum in New York. And I go to New York a lot. And every time I go to New York, I always have my day so filled up that I never yet have gone up there to Central Park to see him. I'm ashamed of that. I don't suppose all of you would be like this with your friends. But when you begin to think about it, oh, aren't there so many things you want to do before you die? I don't know how long I'll live, but I know this, I won't live long enough. I'll just have the tiniest little fraction of my work done. And I suppose that's how every person who thinks about it feels. Time is fleeting, life is short. Work while it is day, for the night cometh when no man can work. Well, this is why it seems increasingly to me that one of the worst sins in the world is to kill time. It's a horrible thing. It's a form of murder. And when I hear people say, "I don't know what to do," oh, how I groan inwardly. I wish they'd give me a little of their time. Of course I'll never catch up. I'll never get all the books written. Or the books read. And neither will you. Now, since we've got just so much time, though we don't know how much, then the thing to do is to use it sacredly. And the way to use it sacredly is to have a rule to live by in regard to time. Because then, by following the rule, we will be reminded and lifted. Those of you who know me very well know that I make it an almost absolute rule to go to bed every night at 10 o'clock. Last night on the train, I knew that I'd get up early this morning, so I went to bed last night at 8:30, before we got to Harrisburg. And it was wonderful. If any of you haven't tried lately going to bed early, let me suggest, if you don't want to go to sleep right away, what a wonderful time to think, because when you're stretched out flat, more blood goes to your brain and you can think lots better. Well, the awful mistake we make is to live undisciplined in regard to time. Going to bed whenever we feel like it. Getting up whenever we feel like it. One of the things that most impresses us all in the gospel is the way that Jesus would arrive a great while before day to go apart. If he had followed inclination, of course he'd have stayed in bed long. As anybody would. You cannot do it by following inclination. The way to do it is to have a time and live up to it. A time to eat. A time to study. Time to play. One of the hardest things in training children is to get them to do this. I don't mind their playing. What I hate is the time when they're not either playing or working or anything else. When the precious time is being utterly, utterly wasted. They're not even resting. And life is vastly more rich if you can cut it apart. Have chapters in the day and chapters in the week. If you have time to write in your own diary about this day and your decisions of this day, it might be wonderful for you to make some suggestions to yourself about how you will discipline this great gift of God, which is time. And I put it first because it is the fountainhead from which so many of the others come. Especially the second one I shall mention, namely prayer. One of the chief reasons why so many people don't really pray is that they let their lives get all cluttered up. And the best way that I know to pray is to force myself to waken earlier than I need to waken for the duties of the day. And that can soon be done so that it is utterly automatic. I suppose there are people that have to have alarm clocks. But they probably wouldn't if they'd developed the habit of early morning meditation so that you'd miss it terribly if you did not have it. This came to me so vividly on the island of Iona when I was with George MacLeod, and I found that the one discipline that unites all the men there in the fellowship is this discipline that they call the plotted day, of planning the day as through the eyes of God before the day commences. And I cannot too strongly recommend it. And so you see, the discipline of time and the discipline of prayer blend into one another. But of course, prayer is more than just time. We often have very undisciplined prayers. Some public prayers are undisciplined, as we all know. How wonderful to have them made lean and athletic and sharp. Each one must learn that discipline of prayer which is best for him. I don't mind telling you that I am very much helped by bowing my head and by kneeling. And to this day, I am shocked when I see a man in public prayer with his eyes open. I don't want to judge him. I realize that some people might find that helpful. All I say is it isn't helpful to me. And I find that if I actually have my knees down on the floor, that it is often a very good thing indeed. Not because there's anything holy about that, but because I am a feeble creature that needs a reminder of my position before God. And this helps me. And maybe it helps you. If so, don't be ashamed to do it anywhere. One of the great disciplines of prayer is the one which the Kirkridge Fellowship expects of all of its members. Namely, that everyone should every few months have a six-hour retreat alone. There are two things in our devotional life that most of us are afraid of. We are afraid of aloneness, and we are afraid of silence. And this applies to pastors as much as anybody else. One of the first really shocking experiences of my life came when I led the daily devotion of a group of pastors of the Synod of California, of the Presbyterian Church. I realized that in the Synod of Virginia or North Carolina, it would be different. But those were the most undisciplined men I'd ever heard of in my life. The first morning, I went in and took my place on the platform with my head bowed in silent prayer. I continued this for at least 10 minutes. And there those men sat, and you'd have thought they were going to have a fit. One would reach out for a hymn book and look at it. Another would pitch it this way, and then he'd whisper to his neighbors. They thought I'd forgotten my sermon, or that maybe I'd had a stroke. The idea that a man would pray seemed to them inconceivable. Or that he'd be silent, waiting for God's message. I remember once I spoke in a church, and I was sitting there in silence and was very happy when suddenly, right behind me was one of the biggest noises I'd ever heard in my life. It was the choir, bawling out at the top of their voices, and what do you suppose they were saying? The Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before him. Well, some preach and some practice. I suppose that makes a good division of labor. But we need times, all of us, when not a word is said. Probably most of our prayers ought to be silent prayers. And they can be said not only on our knees and in the early morning, they can be said as we go about our work, as we face new responsibilities, and as we travel, as we sit behind the wheel, as we walk to the platform. Always the prayer, we can develop this discipline of having it just underneath, ready to bubble out as the natural part of our lives. But above all, it must be disciplined prayer, that is, with time, with methods. If we don't, we'll delude ourselves and days will go without any. That gives you two positive ones, the discipline of time and the discipline of prayer. The third is the discipline of Scripture. We all know that the Bible is in every way the preeminent book. And we all know that we ought to use it. But there are countless alleged Christians who go for weeks at a time without any acquaintance with it. As I began living in cities where I saw a great many Roman Catholics, especially Roman Catholic priests, the first thing that struck me was that every time that I got on a streetcar or a subway, here I would see a priest sit down and immediately whip out his prayer book. I've seen it this past week. Many of you have seen it also. That is, they have the requirement of going through a certain number of prayers and meditations every day of their lives. Of course, the Orthodox Jew is the same. Every really Orthodox Jew goes through the full prayer book service every morning of his life in Hebrew. And as I watch these people, I often wish that my friends and I could be as disciplined, that there'd be something required of us. And I looked around and saw that our people gloried in having nothing required. One of the chief reasons, of course, why there is such a large attendance at Mass is that they have required attendance. That's the only word for it. That's exactly what it is. Everyone has required attendance and is expected to report any failures in that regard. Well, I agree that some of them probably go just in a meaningless way. But there's always a chance that in fulfilling the rules, in maintaining the requirements, light from God's word may break into their hearts. And I don't for the life of me see why Protestants ought to have any less standard in this than the Orthodox Jews and the Roman Catholics. We need not have the same requirements. We ought not to have a lesser one. And if we're concerned, we will not have. Well, the Bible is the obvious book, isn't it, to fulfill this need. I look forward to the time now when I see lots of people on the train flip out their Bibles. I see a few now, only a few. Something is changing, but I see a few. I hope for the time while I live when you'll see many people who will take their Bibles out and read their scripture for the day, unashamed, unapologetic about it. I don't see any reason why not. We could begin with the people here. Just think what it would mean if all the people at Massanutta would become the nucleus of such a move. And it's especially important if you do it that you don't do it hit and miss. Those who go through the prayer book don't go hit and miss. You can divide up, let us say, the Gospels into sections, and it is extremely helpful. In my office in Washington, we've divided up Matthew into 70 sections, Mark into 57, Luke into 90, John into 90. And a number of people are getting those lists and are following it. It means you take about 12 or 14 verses a day. In Indiana Methodism, the bishop there, Bishop Raines, liked the idea so well that they sent this out to their churches. And last fall, 6,240 people in Indiana Methodism signed up for these daily readings. Now, some of them will fail. They won't all keep the rules. But a vast number of them will. And lives may be changed thereby. And if you decide to follow this, I strongly urge you to get a cheap Bible that you don't mind marking. Underline. Make your notes in the margin. And date it every time. When you read tonight, date it August 17, 1955, at the end of your little reading. And tomorrow, date it August 18, 1955. And then in the coming years, you can look back and you'll see what you were doing then. And you will know that you were not deluding yourself in following this rule. If you don't do this, you're almost sure to delude yourself. The fourth positive discipline is the discipline of money. Now, this was touched upon by our friend from Scotland most helpfully today under the heading of stewardship. He was dealing, of course, as he should have, with the stewardship of all of life. But money is a special test because money is a measuring stick of labor. Money is, of course, chiefly frozen work. You work harder, and you work longer and more ably, and other things being equal, more money comes. You have thus more money to spend, to use, and to give. And so work and money are very closely associated and ought to be. That's the reason that it's holy, because work is holy. Now, I don't know whether your experience is like mine or not, but I'll tell you, my problem lies not in my willingness to give. My problem lies not in my giving, but in my spending. I don't find it very hard to have people willing to give a definite portion of their income if they have it. But they want that refrigerator so badly. After all, the old model is 5 years old. Who wants a 5-year-old refrigerator? And that new car, I know what I'm talking about. I was terribly tempted this summer to buy a new car. My Pontiac will be 5 years old in October, and I almost convinced myself that I would save money to buy a new car. Now, of course, I wouldn't. I realize that when I think seriously or prayerfully about the matter. I would enjoy having a new car, and I suppose someday, if I can afford it, I'll get one. But I know this. Chiefly, when I don't have enough money to give to things, it's because I've already got the money spent. Now, you may not be that way, being, as I said, the righteous crowd that came up the hill in the rain. But I find that lots of other people are like that. And so I wish that in the discipline of money, we would put the emphasis on the other end from where we normally put it. Not so much on what we're willing to give as what we are willing to save out of our standard of living so that we have something to give. And practically all of us live on too high a standard of living financially. And I count myself a sinner in this regard right along with all the others. And so if we would try to have a discipline that would make sense in our day, we would develop one in which we would have more simple taste. I may say that one of the big troubles in family life is, of course, the overspending which the advertising of gadgets produces. So that there's this tension to have more money because you want more things. And it may turn out that this is one of the worst evils in our family existence. The advertisers may have a lot to account for. But any positive discipline will include money. And there will be a lot of giving. And the best way to do it is to plan your year, plan what you'll spend, plan how much you'll have to give. And then you have a pool from which to dip. That gives us four. Now the fifth is the discipline of thought. God gave us these marvelous minds. It is our responsibility to use them well. And here we have such a temptation to laxity and to indolence. Reading magazines all the time is a good deal like eating candy all the time. It is too easy. Just think how easy it is to pick up Life or Look and read them. They virtually are satisfactory to people who can't read at all. If they're therefore a help to the human race, well, then I thank God for them. And I'll admit that I look at them once in a while. A man even gave me a subscription to Life as a Christmas present, and I've seen a few of the copies, not very many. I don't have time. But just think of the people that have these excellent minds, and they just go along year after year, never struggling with really hard thinking at all. I've told some of you how my late wife tried to help the women at Stanford University in teaching their children. And how they kept coming to her asking for Bible story books. And she would say, why don't you teach them the Bible yourself? And every woman said she wasn't able to, though they supposedly had college education. That is, They had ceased to use their minds in this area as though their education hadn't really done anything for them at all. And a lot of our wanted education is fake. When you realize that all of our people, by law, have to go to school till they're 14 or 16 in most states, you know that a lot of our education has been a horrible failure. When you say, see the way they think and act and read or fail to read. Well, at least Christians can force upon themselves a higher standard. Read at least one really hard book a year. That wouldn't be very much, but how it might change your life. And many of you ought to write. I've been working on Pauline Trublad's essays the last 5 weeks. It's been the hardest labor of my life. They're being edited and will come out on the anniversary of her death, that is the 7th of February, 1956. The title we expect to be My Place and My Peace. Because at one point in her journal, she said, I have found my place and my peace slowly, but I have found them. She had pernicious anemia for 27 years. And when she was often too weak to be up, which was a great deal of the time, she would sit in bed and read marvelous books and write. She filled at least 20 notebooks. She wrote a full book for each of our four children, which they have now, which of course will never be published. But she found, she said, that the writing, which was an intellectual discipline, was a very great help because it clarified her mind. And when there was something she didn't understand, she started writing about it. I would especially urge that upon the women present who may never have tried it. Get a notebook. Start writing about the things that confuse you or perplex you or where you need help. And you may find that this very effort will itself be beneficent and clarifying. But it's work. It's work all the way through. So many people come to an author and they say, tell me how to write a book, as though there were some easy way. Well, of course there isn't any easy way. It's just labor, labor, labor all the time. When I was writing Declaration of Freedom, I had to do it under great pressure because of my work in the government. I did it a year ago now, the first part, and then finished it up by the 1st of November. And during the first writing, I had to make myself write 8 hours a day, sitting right straight on that chair with the white paper in front of me. And I want to tell you that that is a disciplined job, and that is not easy. And the temptations that come to a man to leave the desk under those circumstances are enormous. Don't suppose that anything in this world comes easy. Preaching isn't even easy. You have to think of what to say. Raising a family isn't easy. Nothing worthwhile comes without a disciplined effort. Now you may think about it. If you do, I wish you'd tell me what they are. I mean others that belong to this category. Positive rules of life, which are helps and reminders to poor, struggling men and women like us. To keep ourselves straight, and thus to wear Christ's yoke. I have used this text before at Massanetta, and I use it again. Obviously, Jesus was talking about discipline when he said, come unto me, all ye who are weary and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Learn of me, and you will find rest for your soul. Let us pray. Oh, Father, we would pray for our loved ones in this stormy night, that thou would keep them in thy care, and all whom thou dost love. In Jesus' name.